Thank you for tuning in to the Best of Movie Geeks United, a collection of a few of our most memorable conversations from our archives. On tonight's show, we have a trio of outstanding actresses, beginning with Patricia Clarkson, who came on to discuss her performance in an independent romance titled Cairo Time. She's followed by actress Dana Delaney, who hit it big on TV's China Beach, and went on to a successful film career in movies like House Sitter and Light Sleeper. Miss Delaney came on our show to talk about the film Light Sleeper, in which she collaborated with famed writer-director Paul Schrader. And finally, Kelly McGillis, an actress that hit the zeitgeist with her performance in the hit 1986 film Top Gun. Now in this latest stage of her career, she's starring in a string of horror films. She came on our show to talk about one of those films, titled Stakeland. Our first guest tonight is a goddess among actresses. She's one of the most beloved and revered talents in films today, from her screen debut in Brian De Palma's The Untouchables, all the way to her stunning turns in Woody Allen's Vicky Cristina Barcelona and Whatever Works, and Scorsese's Shutter Island. Her new film is Cairo Time, and in the film she plays Juliet, a character who finds herself swept up in an unexpected romance against the backdrop of exotic Cairo. And we spoke to Patricia about the experience of shooting in Cairo and the arc of her character and working alongside directors Woody Allen and Martin Scorsese. This interview was conducted by another one of the movie geeks, Aaron Adidias. So enjoy Patricia Clarkson. Here she is.
Reason for the visit?
I'm here to see my husband.
Miss Juliet, I'm sorry. Unfortunately, your husband has been delayed in Gaza. If there's anything you should need, please.
Oh, Mark, where are you? How long do you think?
I can't say. Sorry, that long I'll go crazy.
You know me.
I'm going crazy. Men keep following me. Why is everyone staring?
They're like beautiful women.
It's been years since young men.
I find that hard to believe. Why don't I take you to the palace?
Mark and I made a promise we'd see them together.
Of course.
I like your dress.
This is a Galabia.
Oh.
Tomorrow I will take the day.
You can do that?
Of course.
Saw your film last night. Terrific film. Great performance, as usual.
So, oh, thank you.
I was curious. So, how did you get involved with this material? How did this script come to you?
In just a conventional way, you know. I my agent called and said you've been offered a movie. I'm sending you the script. I think it's a script you're gonna really like, and then he said, no, you're going to love it. I think you're going to love this, and I did. And Ruben Nada, the writer-director extraordinaire, flew to New York. We sat down for what was to be about a 45-minute cup of coffee, and it turned into a three-hour just extravaganza.
Right.
And next thing I knew, I was on a plane to Cairo.
And that was that sort of an appeal to you of film, making a movie in Cairo?
No. I don't really, well, yes, I mean, you know, the idea of going to this extraordinary, exotic location, but it's not really why I would ever take a part or a film. It is solely based on the script and the character, but it was a bonus. But I was a little frightened of going to Cairo as an American, and I was a little wary. But all of my fears were unfounded. It's not so much being an American in Cairo. You have to be a little wary of being just a Western woman in Cairo.
Right.
In certain areas, you have to be careful where you go, unchaperoned, without alone. But that's the exception, not the rule in this film.
And the thing about your character in the movie, you know, it's a very, her time there, it leaves a very visceral impact on her. It's kind of she's not going to ever forget her time in Cairo. So one has to assume that while maybe not as traumatic as her experience, but also there's some of that also with you when you left Cairo. Was there some of that with you also?
You mean some of that with me, Patty, when I left Cairo?
Yeah, you know, the experience of, you know, being there for, I think it was 25 days.
Oh, yes. I mean, it was life and art, and I was there for 7 weeks, so I really almost lived in Cairo for, I really did, and I truly experienced Cairo, and the good, the bad, and the ugly, and it's a breathtakingly beautiful city, but it has, you know, aching poverty and difficulty. And,
right.
But I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
And your character, Juliet, she goes through this kind of this very subtle transformation.
Subtle is the right word, yes.
And throughout the film. And I'm wondering, as an actress, what if that's more appealing of trying to modulate that kind of small transformation versus kind of a major epiphany that, you know, that also happens in some characters.
No, it's one of the hardest journeys I've ever had to chart as an actor. And one that will stay with me forever. I think it made me a better actor, which is what you want to do. You know, you want to continue to grow as an actor, even if the ripe old age I have. You want to, and so it was very difficult because it's such an internal and such a personal, and she moves in half notes, and it was very difficult, but ultimately rewarding. It was so rewarding.
Right. Well, here's a kind of a silly actor question, and it's more about technique. But in this film, you have a lot of telephone scenes.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious about...
Not telephone sex, telephone scenes. Oh, God.
And what is... Telephone acting.
What has been
your relationship with that over the years? Have you gotten better at it, or is it always...
Yes, I mean, you hope. It's all still the same thing. It's still a scene, very much so.
Mm-hmm.
It's still a scene. And you have to really... It's still very... I mean, you can't view it any other way, or you're dead in the water.
Is it better to have someone on the line, or does it not matter?
You know, yes, it's always great to have someone on the line, but also sometimes you can't, also because of sound and... Sometimes it's very difficult, and so you have to actually really do your homework and know exactly what you're talking about and what you have to chart it out. You have to write it out. I really actually write it in my script. Everything that I'm talking about, what the response is. Because sometimes I often was doing a lot of those scenes without anyone on the other end.
What's been the audience reaction to this film? It's been on the festival circuit. Now it's going out.
Incredible. Wherever we've taken it, and you realize this film is played in Toronto, where it won Best Canadian.
Right.
It's in Doha, where it was so well received the first screening that they saved it for closing night. We went to Dublin. Then we went to Aruba. I mean, we've been to San Francisco. It's had such a beautiful response. I'm a little frightened. I'm thinking, oh my God, when's the shoe going to drop? But who knows?
The last two questions I got to ask. One, my favorite film of the year so far is Shutter Island. You're terrific in it. And so I'm wondering, that character is very pivotal to that story. You have one, you know, this major scene in it. So I was wondering, what could you tell me about that experience doing that, you know, working with Scorsese and doing that?
Well,
it's
an actor's dream. You're working with one of the great directors of all time, and he doesn't disappoint. It was a beautiful experience. I was acting opposite Leonardo, and he, again, one of the great actors working today, and he doesn't disappoint either. So you have to be ready to rock and roll with Mark Scorsese. You just do. You have to come ready to rock and roll. It's a very visceral, it's a very almost primal experience, and it's fun.
And finally, I want to ask you, you've worked with Woody Allen twice on back-to-back Vicky Cristina Barcelona, which is one of our other co-hosts consider that one of the best films of the decade, and also Whatever Worked, which I consider a vastly underrated comedy by Woody Allen.
I do, too. I think I love the movie so much, and I'm just so honored and thrilled to have been a part of it.
Both of those are two very different types of Woody Allen films. One's broad comedy, one's a little more romantic and serious. And so I was just curious, is his approach to directing, was it any different on either film?
I not from what I gathered, no. You know, Woody's, you know, a singular experience. He has his vision, he has his way of working. I mean, he's just been doing it for so long now, and he's such a master.
Mm-hmm.
And he just knows how to do it. And I don't think I think he approaches, you know, every story with the same set of, with the same parameters, with the same, I guess, insights, and whether it's a melancholy romance or a kind of bolder comedy, comedy of manners almost.
Right.
I think he comes at it the same way.
Well, before I let you go, what's coming up next for you? What do you have coming up?
I have, you know, this movie opens August, and then I have EZA coming up, this wonderful, funny comedy starring Emma Stone and Stanley Tucci, and I play her kind of very kooky, eccentric parents, and then I have a film called Legendary, and Danny Glover and a wonderful young actor named Devin Gray, and that comes out both of those come out in September. So it's a wham bam, thank you ma'am, next couple of months. I'm just like, I have to lie down when I think about it.
We're honored to welcome our next guest to the show tonight, an extraordinarily gifted actress who's given exceptional and haunting performances in two of Schrader's most challenging works, Patty Hearst and Light Sleeper. Her resume also includes fantastic work in films like House Sitter, Moon Over Parador, Tombstone, Fly Away Home, and landmark television series like Magnum P.I., Justice League, The L Word, Battlestar Galactica, Jerry, you were talking about that.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And of course, the show that initially launched her career into the stratosphere, China Beach, for which she received two Emmy nominations and two Emmy wins for Best Actress. She's currently heating up the small screen again with her recent role of Catherine Mayfair in the television phenomenon Desperate Housewives. And, Jerry, I know you watch that every week.
You know, I did. I really did.
I know you do. I know you do. I did it, my friend. Guilty pleasure. It is a great joy to welcome Dana Delaney to our program. Ms. Delaney, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Good evening.
Good evening.
Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Oh, this is a great treat for us. This seems like a great time for you. I mean, I look on the cover of Entertainment Weekly magazine, and there you are, and you have this great new role in Desperate Housewives. Is this an exciting time?
It is nice. You know, I've never stopped working. You just sort of go in waves, and this is sort of a little bit of a crest right now.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Tell me about that set, working on that show. Is that a lively, fun set?
Yeah, it is fun. I mean, it's very much its own world, and that took a little getting used to at first because it's this strange hybrid of soap opera and sitcom that
right.
I think it's really the first time that anybody's really been able to pull off that tone and make it last. And I think
yeah.
that Mark Cherry has some kind of savant thing going there. I don't even begin to understand it.
But I would think that would have to be at first, because you know that's for all intents and purposes it's a family that's existed for several years already.
Mm-hmm.
Have to be a little intimidating to kind of walk into that and try to become acclimated with that.
Yeah, I'm you know I just sort of think of it as work, and so I kind of keep my head down, do my job, concentrate, and then hopefully the rest will follow. And
right.
it has. Everybody, you know, at first, understandably, everybody was kind of like, you know, why do we need another cast member? It's already so big.
Mm.
But now it's been great. I just sort of feel like I'm part of the family.
Now you did quite a bit of TV and a few films before your first collaboration with Mr. Schrader,
mm-hmm.
with Patty Hearst. Was there an audition process for Patty Hearst? What was that experience like?
It's funny. Yeah, I met with Paul on that, and I had long hair, and he said to me, would you cut your hair off for the movie? Because, you know, the original Angela Atwood, which was not her real name. I'm trying to remember. It was Angela something. Anyway, she had this bob. I said, yeah, sure. So that was the origin of my bob, was because Angela had one.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the middle of shooting Patty Hearst, I got cast in China Beach.
Mm.
So I was shooting the pilot of China Beach and Patty Hearst simultaneously, so that's why I ended up having that bob for China Beach, was mm. Patty Hearst.
Oh, wow. So what? I'm sure you knew about Schrader's work prior to working with him.
Yes.
Yes. What surprised you about him? Because obviously his work, just judging on his work, you expect this incredibly intense person. Is that mm-hmm. pretty much what you found on set?
Yeah, I mean, Paul is intense. There's nobody like Paul. He is truly an auteur, you know, and there's not many of those left.
Yeah.
He has a vision, and it's very clear what he wants from top to bottom. You know, he oversees everything. He's such a visual person. Especially for somebody who, you know, is an intellectual, it's interesting to have that mix. So the look is important to him. And, yeah, he is intense, you know. He's what I imagined when I was starting acting, what a film director should be.
yeah. But how exactly does he direct? I mean, you've worked with him twice now.
Yeah.
Well,
the first time it was just terrifying. Because he's so smart, and you know, he expects a lot. He gave us all a lot of research about the period during the Patty Hearst movie.
Right.
We all had a lot of books to read, and then we all went up to San Francisco. I don't know if you know all this, but we went up to San Francisco, and all the people cast of the SLA, including Natasha Richardson, who was playing Patty.
Right.
And we lived in this horrible apartment in San Francisco. We were supposed to pretend we were the SLA for a week.
Right.
And sleep,
you know,
on the floor.
we just spoke to William Forsythe.
Oh, well, Bill could tell you. Yeah.
Yeah. He started telling us. He could tell us a little bit more about that. How did that help you as an actor? I would think that would be invaluable.
Well, did he tell you how long we lasted doing it?
No.
I think it was 2 days. I mean, we were all supposed to take turns cooking and do all this stuff and, you know, dress in our cross-dressing outfits and all. And by the end, it was so funny because Natasha was the only one of us who really cooked, and she sort of became the mother hen of all of us.
Oh, wow.
And then we couldn't really deal with it. We all ended up staying in some crappy motel instead. We were
light,
too spoiled.
Light Sleeper was another just fantastic
yes.
role. Tell for our audience who aren't aware, tell us a little bit about that film and the character you play.
Well, that was what was great for me was it was sort of Paul was my bookend because before I did China Beach, I did Patty Hearst, and then my first movie after China Beach was Light Sleeper.
Right.
And it was so nice to go back to Paul because, Yeah, I mean, that's part of his trilogy of The Loner, The American Gigolo, and...
The Walker, I think, was the third.
Was the third one.
Yeah, the third one.
Yeah, and he, again, was great. It was such a beautifully written role. It was just beautifully written from beginning to end. Nothing changed. It was just as scripted. Nothing ever changes in Paul's scripts because they're so pure.
Oh, yeah.
And, again, he knows exactly what he wants. And I just remember him saying to me, and he kind of will screw with you. You know, he likes to mess with you a little bit. He likes to play with your head.
I can imagine that.
And you know, just like an, I mean, this is how I thought directors would be, those little games that they play. And he's from that old-time school of doing that, of trying to psychological games with you. And I remember he took me out to dinner after a couple of days of shooting Light Sleeper, and Paul likes to drink wine, and I like to drink wine. So we were having our wine and talking, and he said, you know, it's not like television. He said, you've been doing television for a long time now. He says, you don't have to do the same thing in every take.
Right.
And I was so insulted. Because I didn't think I was doing the same thing.
Right, oh my.
I mean, that is the worst thing you can say to an actor, because he's just basically saying you're a hack.
This is something that we've heard about him, though, that he is very blunt and straightforward.
He'll tell you what's on his mind.
Yes, and also I think he was really screwing with me, too, because he knew that that would upset me.
Right, put you on edge.
Yeah, because I always thought of myself as so inventive. So it was great, because believe me, the next time I went to the set, I was trying everything possible.
Well, he strikes me as one of those directors that you can take those chances with, and you can explore different directions for a character. You know, did you consider these like major risky roles for you? I mean, did you feel like you were taking risks with these characters?
No, not really, because I actually have a sensibility a lot like Paul's. I mean, the darker, the better for me. I love that. I love going there, and so I felt really at home working with him. It felt very natural for me.
This is something that's very, very interesting to me, because we think of Paul Schrader, and we think, like you said, the lonely man, the outsider. We always think of the strong male presence in his films, so... With something like Patty Hearst and Light Sleeper, what does that tell us about his understanding and his portrayal of women?
I think, the thing that people probably don't realize about Paul is what a huge heart he has. He's extremely sentimental, and I think he doesn't really like to show that a lot. But he's a very, very kind person, really, at heart, and very, very sensitive.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, especially in Light Sleeper, the character that Susan Sarandon played,
mm-hmm.
it's just heartbreaking. The whole movie is heartbreaking.
Oh, yeah.
To me. And then my character, Marianne, I mean, that journey that she takes from getting her life together to just at the end, you know, you just know she's just not going to make it.
Right.
It's sad. And I think Paul relates to that kind of thing as a human being of the demons inside. He, you know, he's got his own demons like we all do.
Yeah,
I have a question from the chat room. Actually,
yeah, go ahead.
Does he allow for any improv on the set?
When we did Patty Hearst, there was improv,
right?
But not so much on Light Sleeper because it was such a tight script.
Mm-hmm.
So not, I don't remember doing a lot in that.
I mean, you've been acting for quite some time now. How rare is it to get a script like that really, I mean, it's all on the page?
Very rare, especially these days.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't know how spoiled I was, you know, that I got to start out doing something like that.
Mm.
Yeah.
We interviewed Jeff Goldblum mm-hmm. about his collaboration with Mr. Schrader, and he said that Schrader is a wonderful kind of raconteur as well, that he's an excellent storyteller of Hollywood and his dealings with Hollywood. Do you recall any kind of stories with your time with him?
Yes, there are many, many stories. Most of them you can't say.
Actually, this is uncensored radio. You can say whatever you want.
You can say whatever you want. You can say whatever you want.
You know, I can't remember specifically. I'm sorry. But it's just Paul himself is such a character.
Right.
I mean, that's what I remember, just hanging out with him, because he will always put his own foot in his mouth. Because that's what I mean. He's so endearing, because on one hand, he's such an intellectual, so smart, and such a, you know, an encyclopedia of film knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, he will always offend somebody somehow with what he says.
That's great. He's provocateur. It's,
yeah.
It's wonderful. And again, he's working with Willem Dafoe in Light Sleeper as well, who you obviously acted opposite of in the film.
Mm-hmm.
And they've collaborated many times. He almost seems to be, in a sense, Schrader's muse.
Yeah, mm-hmm. No, it's true. And
what,
I think
what,
part of that is because Willem is such a lovely man. You know, he's also got that dichotomy going, because his exterior is so extraordinary looking and
yeah.
sometimes frightening. And yet inside, he's just the softest creature. And somehow that works, you know, the contrast of that.
He even said that he likes Willem when he is vulnerable. Most people use him for, you know, the tough villain, but he enjoys the vulnerability of Willem Dafoe.
Oh, he was so vulnerable in Light Sleeper.
And also autofocus, too. I mean,
yes.
I loved autofocus.
Yeah.
I thought
yeah.
that was great. Think of the look of that film. It
mm-hmm.
so captured that period.
Yeah.
It's
rare to
get a director these days who writes and directs and also creates a world unto himself. And Paul is one of the few left that still does that.
Right.
Absolutely. We have a phone call. We have a caller. Let's see if we can pick it up, see if this has a question for you here on the line. 703, you're on the air. Go right ahead.
Hello, Miss Dana.
Hello.
I've been following your career with great interest for a long time. My name is Michael from the beautiful state of Virginia.
Oh, hi, Michael.
Happy belated birthday. You get better with age.
Thank you.
Are you done shooting Desperate Housewives, or is it still going on?
We have, let's see, we're just starting episode 14. We have 3 more to go.
I'm sorry I missed being able to get to New York last year to see you on stage.
Oh, yes. I had a great time doing it. I did this Neil Abute play last fall off-Broadway called Things We Said Today that was really fun to do.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he's another. You know what? I see a lot of similarity between Neil and Paul. They're
I do, too.
Similar.
Now that you mentioned
yeah,
that, I was going to bring that up. Thank you, by the way, Michael, for calling in.
Thank you, Michael.
Yeah, tell me about that similarity you see.
Well, again, it's funny. I'd never really thought about it before.
But it's there.
It's there. They're both really smart and extremely, words, you know, great with the script, and yet also really sensitive with their direction. And Neil also creates his own world, you know, it's his own world view that you get. And you always know when you see a Neil Abute piece, and you know when you see a, you know, Paul Schrader piece.
That's very true.
And they're also the same thing. They've got this dichotomy going where on the outside, I think they scare people.
Right.
But on the inside, they're the sweetest men. They really are. And I don't think people get to see that side to them that often.
I would say it's really true with Neil Abute. Oh,
yeah,
yeah,
very much so. And you know, they're not afraid to explore the extremes.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of it has to do with male, female,
mm-hmm.
you know,
yeah.
issues. And I think they've both been accused of misogyny, and I think it's unfair on both counts.
Yeah. So how do you place these two in the scope of your career, if you're able to be objective about your own career? How do you place these two collaborations with Schrader?
I would still say to this day that Light Sleeper is my favorite movie that I've done.
Mm.
And it's too bad that it was so early in my career.
Well, it hasn't been all downhill since Light Sleeper.
No, but in terms of sensibility, my personal sensibility,
yeah,
that was the
yeah.
closest to it.
Yeah. At the same time, I know you have several films on the horizon.
Mm-hmm.
You have, I think, like 4 films awaiting release. Would you like to tell us about some of those?
Well, you know, it's this world of indie filmmaking. And
right.
you do them and you hope for the best, and then you see what happens. And they're all very different. One in particular that I liked was called Multiple Sarcasms. That's with Tim Hutton and Mira Sorvino.
Uh-huh.
That a guy named Brooks Branch directed. It's his first movie. He wrote it and directed it. And one of the things that's fun about it is it's very much in that 70s vein of movies like Starting Over and Paul Mazursky and
mm-hmm.
those kind of movies, Pakula.
He's got quite a cast.
Yeah, and he really, I think, captures the feeling of that period, which was a great period for filmmaking, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So just to end on a Schrader question, what do you think his identity is in film? What is his legacy?
Well, I mean, obviously he'll always be known as the man who wrote Raging Bull and Taxi Driver.
Right.
I mean, those, and also, you know, Last Temptation of Christ. The Scorsese connection will always be there.
Yeah, that's for sure.
But I think for him himself, as a director, I think that he will be very unique and sort of part of a dying breed of director, which makes
sadly,
me sad.
Sadly so, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm afraid you're right.
Yeah, we're talking about this with our first guest tonight, that it's very sad and very telling that someone like Paul Schrader has to work 3 or 4 years in between films just to raise financing for the next one.
It just pains me to see what he goes through now in terms of trying to work within the system.
Yeah.
You know, because, I mean, he was doing those movies that now we would call indie movies, but back then, you know, the studios paid for them.
Right.
And it pains me to see him go through what he has to go through now to get a script made.
Well, especially, I think he said in an interview himself that Autofocus and Affliction, they didn't lose money. They made money.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
But not the kind of money that automatically allows them to start up another one with their finances.
Yeah. And they just provided great roles for actors.
Oh, they're amazing.
Each time out of the gate, it does.
Yeah, I mean, just to see James Coburn like that, oh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Killed me.
Oh, absolutely.
Killed me. And what a great role, you know, for him to end his career mm-hmm. on.
Yeah.
And the same thing to see Greg Kinnear play a part like that.
Well, I think that's really the changing point for Greg Kinnear. It's after that he starts to get the more darker, more serious
mm-hmm.
parts, The Matador,
mm-hmm.
Little Miss Sunshine, even just
yeah.
things outside his comfort area.
Yeah, and also, you know, it's funny, because he was in that Neil LaBute movie, Nurse Betty.
That's right.
Yes, yes.
And he was great in that.
He was.
There's the LaBute connection again.
Yeah.
And there's something interesting to me about the how fascinated he is with the contrast. I mean, you see it with a movie like Hardcore, which we mentioned before you came on,
mm-hmm.
and certainly with Autofocus. There's something about, I think he enjoys exploring a character acting in a way that is the complete opposite of what's in his best interest, what he knows to be in his best interest.
Well, first of all, that's great drama right there.
Yes.
And mm-hmm. sorry
right.
about that. But, you know, you can't ignore Paul's upbringing. It's his own internal struggle,
right.
being raised a Calvinist in Michigan, and yet at heart, I mean, he's such I wouldn't say a hedonist, but he's he enjoys life, you know, he lives it fully, and he has great taste and appetite, and they, you know, they wouldn't be that extreme, be held in such extreme if he wasn't told he couldn't do things as a kid.
Right.
Right, right. Well, Ms. Delaney, thank you so much for being with us tonight.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Great pleasure.
It was fun.
And we love you here on the show. Please come back and join us anytime.
Yeah,
right, thank you.
So tonight we're going to talk with the talents involved in the new film Stakeland. Stakeland. Starting with Kelly McGillis, who we all know and love from Top Gun, The Accused.
Witness.
That was her first big movie.
That was
that,
and I always forget The Accused. I was thinking, well, yeah, The Accused is a good one, yeah.
She's actually, in this interview, she talks a little bit about what drew her to a horror film, which is her first, but not her last. It's
right.
a genre that she doesn't like.
Mm-hmm.
And also a little bit about her past career. Kind of opens up when she says, well, the difference between then and now is that I used to be famous. And so we talk a little bit about fame.
Mm-hmm.
So here's Kelly McGillis. The movie Stakeland opens up in limited release this Friday, April 22nd. Here's Kelly. I read that you normally don't like these kinds of films, so whatever possessed you to do one?
Well, because they called me and it shot down the road from me and I could visit with friends and stay with friends and they paid me a little money and it was fun and I got to go back to where I used to live and visit a bunch of people. So, and then it turned out that I really adored working with Jimmy Mickle and Nick and Connor and everybody. It was just really, it was really fun. I'm really glad that I did it. But no, I have never seen a horror movie save when I was about 8 years old, and that was the first one and the last one I ever watched.
Oh, wow. So, but what is the environment on, because it's a, you said you love the people you worked with, but is there a different kind of chemistry when you're working on this type of material in terms of the tone of the set at all?
No, I don't think so. I really think that that is something that just either works or doesn't work. It doesn't really mm-hmm. matter what the venue is, you know, and I just really think that everybody on this project really was just incredibly wonderful because they really were passionate about what they were doing. These are all people, I guess, who know about that genre, mm-hmm. unlike me, and they were really all into that part. I just thought it was very sweet. I'm like, oh, how cute.
Do you find that a lot in independent films that you work on now, that there is that kind of passion involved?
Yes, I do, actually. I mean, I think that, yes. Yes, I think that there's a hunger there, and I think that there is a drive there, and that I guess people just don't take things for granted, which I really like.
Mm. And what was it that appealed to you about the role of Sister? What did you enjoy playing in that character?
Oh, I don't know if there was any one thing. I just kind of was, I was more intrigued by the whole story, the apocalyptic kind of theme
mm-hmm.
of the piece itself. That's what interested me at first. And then I think secondly, the character I just thought was interesting because just somebody grappling with their, what is my meaning?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that that's kind of a, I think that's a universal theme. I think that's something that every human being grapples with. Why am I here? What is the meaning of it all? And, you know, I just think that that was interesting to me.
Yeah. So, but I take it that you've, I mean, you haven't seen a horror movie since you were 8 years old, but I take it you've seen this one.
No, I haven't.
You haven't seen this one,
no.
Really?
Yeah, not really. I
oh.
tried to. I tried to, and then I left. I said, I don't like being upset. I like sleeping well at night, and I like having happy dreams. So I really just have no desire to sit through a movie that's going to make me feel icky.
Okay. So I was going to ask you if you the audience reaction to it, but apparently you're not sure of the audience reaction.
Yeah, I'm not the one you want to ask that of.
Even when you're doing it though, and this goes for any movie that you do, can you feel that it's working, or are you never quite sure?
I don't know, because this is the deal here, that as an actor, I do what I do when I'm doing it with the director, the camera, the other actors, and I have my timing that I do, my rhythm, my dance, that my musical piece for that moment. And then mm-hmm. that music goes away and goes into a dark little room or on a computer or somebody with somebody else, and that music is re-edited by somebody else, and the rhythms and the timing becomes a wee bit different depending on what, you know, the image is and all that stuff, the story is, the feelings, all that director, editor want to create at that moment. So it changes. It changes drastically, and with that, I never know.
Yeah. There's so many other kind of variables involved in it, so.
Yes, and I think that, I mean, one of the things about doing theater and why I go back to doing theater is because you're more in control of the music of the piece night to night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, once I do my job on a movie, I'm not in control anymore of what that
yeah.
musical piece will look like.
Does it feel like you, because you do go back to the stage often, does it feel any more or less challenging than your film work?
No, it's just challenging in a different way, you know, and I mean, it's a different medium, so it's just different. I can't really compare it.
Mm-hmm.
Because in doing a theater piece, you're doing it new and different every single night, because that audience that comes in is a character in the play every single night, and that is a different crowd every night. So what's exciting about that to me is that it's absolutely different every time you do it.
Mm-hmm.
It can never be the same, and that shared experience with that group of people will be that one experience that you share forever and always.
Yeah.
Whereas in film, it's stuck there forever.
yeah. And in theater, I mean, it's actually a living thing. I mean, it's live theater, obviously.
Yeah.
So tell me about your career, this breadth of your career, and if acting means something different to you now, if it gives you a kind of different charge now than when you started.
Well, certainly it does, and I certainly would hope so after, I don't know, how long have I been doing it, 30 years, something?
Yeah.
Ask me that question again.
if acting it means something different to you now, the joy you get from it.
Well, yes, it does mean something very different to me now. I don't know. It's hard to explain. You've really stumped me with this question, because I think when I was starting out, I was very naive. I was very it was so much more important than it is today to me. And it doesn't mean that it's not important, if that makes any sense. It's just that I thought it was earth-shattering, and it truly isn't. we could talk about that for 2 hours. Today, I look at it in a way that it's a part of my creativity, my creative self, my expressive self. Mm-hmm. When I was younger, it was the be-all and the end-all of my existence, and today it is not. It's an aspect.
Right.
Of me. It's a part of me, and it's a part that I love and cherish about me, and I honor and respect about me, but it doesn't define me, and if it's crappy and doesn't work out, or I don't get a gig, I'm not going to be suicidal about it.
Right, right.
You know,
right.
Before it was, I don't know, when I was younger, it was incredibly life or death to me, but I don't know if that's just youth or me. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Have you noticed that the, how has the business of it changed for you?
I don't know. You know, I used to be really famous, and now I'm not. And I kind of like the not being. That's how it's changed.
Did you respond well to that kind of fame early in your career?
No, I didn't. I drank a lot and took a lot of drugs. I it was very stressful for me because it's not what I wanted to be when I grew up. I didn't want to be famous. I wanted to be an actress, and
mm-hmm.
It was a real struggle for me. And I think in some ways that is still a struggle for me because I just think it's just not real. It's
right.
Not real. But anyway, and that people say, running around saying they know you, well, they don't know you. You can't possibly know me after talking to me on the phone for 15 minutes.
Mm-hmm,
you know
mm-hmm.
a part of me that I've been willing to share with you, but I am multifaceted, and I'm probably more worthy than a 15-minute phone call in order to get to know, or
right.
a two-hour interview, or even a three-day interview. You can't really know somebody unless you experience their life with them. You know, walk in their life with them. So anyway, that whole weird thing is just weird to me.
Well, and that extends to the audiences as well when they see you on screen and they feel like they know you. I mean, that has to be a very weird part of fame.
It is weird, and it is a disconnect for me because people make assumptions about you that just really irritate the heck out of me, honestly.
Mm-hmm.
But that's okay. I can't control that, and I understand that, and I understand how people have to compartmentalize and kind of label things so that they can understand them, but it's also a frustrating part of it to me because people are so much more than that, than what they do or what they're doing at the moment or,
right.
you know, it's where they've been, where they're going. I don't know. So I don't know. You've asked me a big philosophical question that I could talk about for hours with you.
Well, let me ask you an easier one. If you do get approached, which you certainly do and have your entire career, is it mostly about Top Gun?
Top Gun, Witness, or The Accused.
Mm-hmm. And Top Gun is coming up on, I mean, it's 25 years.
Oh, my God, don't say that. I feel so old.
And it's amazing the life that this movie has had.
I know. Who would have thought? I thought it was a stupid cowboy movie in the sky, and look what happened. Shows you what I know.
Yeah. So you didn't have any expectations of the life this movie would carry?
No, none whatsoever.
Yeah. Before I let you go, I want to ask you about another one of your past films, and you just mentioned it, Witness, because Peter Weir is such an extraordinary director that I'm crazy
amazing.
About.
Amazing.
I'd like to know about him and working with him. What was that
he
like?
He was just beautiful. That's all I can say. He's just a true artist, and I just was so blessed to be able to work with him right out of the gate.
Mm-hmm.
Holy cow. Who would have thunk that ever happened? And just a fantastic artist, and he taught me so much, and I'm so eternally grateful to him.
Yeah, that's a beautiful movie, like all of his films are.
Yes, I think he's just a wonderful, wonderful creative soul.
And do you have any other films in the pipeline?
I have a little movie coming out called The Innkeepers, so another horror movie. I don't know if it's a horror movie, it's a scary movie, but I have another same genre film that I've never seen, and I probably never will, but it's okay. Yeah, so I have that one coming out.
Well, this is an exciting new direction for your career. You could become a scream queen. You could do horror films from now on.
I could. I don't know. Whatever pays the rent, I'm good with.
That's it for this episode of the Best of Movie Geeks United. You can access our entire archive of over 700 filmmaker interviews by visiting moviegeeksunited.net.